I've read all of your essays, and now there's room for improvement. And I'm going to talk about a few principles of writing, a few things that you may be familiar with, but then some very specific kinds of things that will make for rapid improvement. No.
Right.
Oh yeah, I will.
Well, David, we haven't written an essay. Should we be here?
Yes.
Right.
Yep.
I
think we ought to understand one thing at the start. It's important whenever you're in a group talking about writing. Most of us are very sensitive to criticism about our writing. It's hard to take the red marks of an English professor all over your essay when you sort of poured your soul into it.
Right. That's a warning.
I always have a box of Kleenex in my office drawer and need to buy new boxes frequently. I struggled trying to figure out what to do with this first set of your essays, or whether I should mark them the way I would mark a set of essays. And I decided not to mark this first one up with lots of red ink, which I could have done, and which I will do if some of you would like me to. But I thought it might be more fun for you to work at making some of your own improvements that I would have been marking for you, so that you can be more satisfied with, say, a next version of at least some of the paragraphs in your essay than to have me say good or bad next to a lot of them. So we'll spend a little time today talking about, I'm going to hand them back to you and ask you to do a little bit of work on them right here. But still, stay here. I've got some other things we're going to do before that. Now, I'm convinced that the only way any of us improves our writing is simply to learn how to become harsher editors of our own first draft, second draft, third draft, until we get to the point where our first draft is good enough to be our last draft. Not many of us can write that well. I don't know how many drafts you worked on, whether you handed in a first draft or a third draft or what. I can guess on some of them, but no names are being used, though.
Basically the winter program. Essays, right? That you just
that's right.
Yeah.
That's right. But for instance, some people think that a good way to learn how to be a good writer is to read the great writers of humankind and use them as a model. And I don't think it works that way. You know, we've all read great stuff, and it doesn't mean that therefore we can write well. And what I want to help you do is simply to be able to look at any sentence that you've written and make it better. And to look at your writing one sentence at a time and ask yourself, did I use the best words that I could have used here? Did I put that sentence together as well as I could have done it? And if the answer is no, then to give you a few tools to use to help make that sentence better next time. And what happens, and this is the exciting thing about writing, it's frustrating at the very start, just like calligraphy is immensely frustrating to me right now because the letters don't look very good, but I think later on they will, when it becomes habitual to do certain things without having to look over at the model every second. You'll gradually develop some better verbal habits as you write, and pretty soon you'll find yourself noticing your own speaking, your own verbal habits when you speak, and other people's speaking. There are some things, Liz, I think it was you who said that you have a habit of mentally correcting other people's grammar or their language when you hear it. That happens to a person when you become more sensitive to language. There are a few phrases and words that I've been painfully aware of just in the last few weeks here that that I'd be painfully aware of no matter what group of human beings I was with, but they're the kind that grate on my sensitivities, and I'll tell you what they are in a little while. And urge you to drum them out of your system. Another thing to remember, well, I didn't finish the first point. What we need to understand with each other is that what we're trying to do is help each other improve the way in which we say things. And we ought to be able to say, that's a lousy sentence, or at least more gracefully, I think that sentence could be improved. And have the one of us who wrote that sentence not feel totally crushed and personally abused and so forth. I've taken some sentences from your essays, and I've dittoed them off. I'm going to hand them out in a little while, and we're going to improve them. I haven't identified whose sentences they are, but each of you is going to recognize your own sentence there and be embarrassed when we show how much better it could be phrased and written. But that's a part of the learning process. If we aren't willing to go through that, why then we have to do it alone in our own closet, and it's going to take a lot longer to become good writers. The way I teach writing in the Paracollege at St. Olaf is to 4 students at a time, and we stand up the whole time. We're gathered around. We take one person's paper and put it up on one of those slanted shelves in my office. We all have pencils in our hands, almost have our arms around each other, and are correcting one of those students' essays right in front of them. And we break down this kind of embarrassment pretty quickly because, it's a kind of intimate situation, and we laugh at each other and we say, how could I have written that dumb sentence? And pretty soon we aren't bothered by it anymore. And I hope that happens with you, that awkward as it is to have your own ideas out there on a piece of paper and everyone else saying that's not written very well, that's part of the whole process of learning, and we'll all try not to take it personally, but rather as a constructive criticism. Okay, first thing that we have to think of, any writer has to think of when you write, is the audience. We talked about this morning in poetry whether there's an audience for the words of a speaker in a poem. Whenever you and I write, we should be assuming a certain audience, and that governs a lot of what it is that we do. It governs the vocabulary that we use, or the tone of voice, or the formality or informality. And if you aren't thinking of that, remember to consider who's the audience. You use different kinds of language and style and even subject matter when you are writing a letter back home or just talking in the dining hall than you would if you were addressing a congressional hearing or writing an application for a job. There just are different occasions for using language in a different way. So always be keeping in mind who it is you're writing for, because it governs a whole set of other later decisions. And then in almost everything we write, we ought to have what some of us call a controlling purpose. That is, there ought to be some intent that you've got, not just to get to the end of the assignment, but an intent to make a point, to argue a certain issue, to present evidence for this, to make some particular thing clear. You ought to have a purpose that controls a lot of the decisions that you make later on. In other words, you ought to be able to write a sentence like this at the beginning of anything you write. My intent in writing this essay is, finish that sentence. Now, if you can't articulate that, then maybe that's part of the problem in your writing, is that you haven't really figured out what you want to do with this essay or this letter or report on a project. So anytime you write, maybe you don't write your controlling purpose until you're halfway through the essay. Finally, you figure out what it is you want to do in this essay. Then go back, see if you can literally write out your controlling purpose in a sentence, and then see if everything you do helps you achieve that purpose. And you make decisions about vocabulary, about evidence, about organization, about strategy. So those are some kind of big beginning kinds of things that you need to do. Now, when writing is unclear, it can be for a couple of causes. One is that the thinking is unclear. The title I gave to this little session comes from one of my favorite quotations, Quintilian, a Latin writer a couple thousand years ago, said that good writing is clear thinking made visible. I think that's just a remarkable perception. Clear thinking made visible. I consider writing to be one of the miracles of this world. That is, that I can make a few scratches on a piece of paper and hand it to someone else, and some thought in my mind is thereby transferred into the reader's mind. I think that's a miracle, and take constant delight in the fact that that can happen. But all of us want that to happen in a precise way. That is, if we care about what it is up here in our head, we think we have an important idea or just an important thing to say to someone else, and we make some scratches on a piece of paper, what we want is for the reader of those scratches to end up with the exact same thought that we had, rather than some approximation or possibly even an entirely different thought. And we're really disturbed if we aren't communicating exactly what we mean. And that's why language and the use of language and putting together of sentences is so important. If we care about our ideas, we care that somebody else gets the same idea rather than a different one, or something that's misguided. And we all know how much unhappiness and disaster and tragedy there has been in the world because people failed to communicate what was in our mind precisely to someone else. We all have personal and national kind of disasters because of the failure to do that. So I think we all have reason to want to make that transfer exact. And that's why those of us who teach writing care about what some people see as picayune details. That is, sometimes a comma can make the difference between exact communication and approximate. It's why choosing your words carefully is crucial, because we all know what's in our own mind, and we sometimes forget that somebody else, the only access somebody else has to our mind is what we're scratching on that piece of paper. And we have to pick, from a dozen possible words, we have to pick the one that does the best job of that miracle of communication. It's crucial that we pick the right one. So precision is extremely important. Just as an example, one phrase, one word that, here's the first of those that I hope you will drum out of your vocabulary. You hear it every day from the most learned of people in the most prestigious of journals and in everyday dinner table conversation, and that's the verb deals with. We're always saying, this book deals with this topic. What does deals with mean? If you say X deals with Y, simply means there's some kind of relationship, right? That's about all that it really means, is that there's a relationship to someone else. Now, when I was trying to get Karen to marry me, I don't think I ever said, I deal with you. No. Out under the moonlight, I chose a better verb than that.
You're not kidding.
I wanted to define the relationship a little more precisely than it deals with. And it's really one of those kind of cop-out words that allows you not to have to think very carefully.
Sometimes you dealt with
it
badly, too.
Well, probably so. And I'm glad you don't define it any more precisely. There are times when you want to use a vague word like that. But that's an example of a word that's extremely vague, and you've got to have a solid reason for using a word as amorphous as that. There are hundreds of different relationships that you might be meaning. You might be meaning any one of hundreds when you say deals with. And what you ought to do is pick out the one that's most precise and exact. And that's a way to communicate exactly what you mean, instead of just saying, well, there's some relationship. This book has a relationship with the topic love, or this person has some kind of relationship with another person. Pick the word exactly, and whenever you catch yourself using deals with, strike it out and go to the thesaurus if you have to pick out a better one. If you've never used a thesaurus, by the way, it's a marvelous little thing and you should use it without embarrassment. It's that word book that where you can look up a word that you want to use but you think it isn't quite right, and it'll give you 20 other words that mean very close to the same thing. And one of those might sound great to you and be just the word you want. Well, it's also good to use a dictionary to make sure that other nice-sounding word actually means what you think it does. And sometimes we make that mistake. I haven't checked yet. And you can get a, you know, a Bantam thesaurus for 95 cents probably in paperback, and it ought to be a well-thumbed thing on anybody's desk.
I'm sure that there are copies around. You may have one with you. I have a copy. Somebody's edition, Roger's thesaurus.
Yeah, Roger is the usual one.
I must admit I haven't overused it.
Yeah. Somebody you'll find it very handy when you're at the point of revising a sentence to make it say just what you mean and you just can't think of the right word. Pick the first one that comes to mind that you know is inadequate. Look it up in the thesaurus, and the word you want is probably there. And it's just a handy way to find it. Another thing that cropped up on a number of the papers, and this is a very common problem, people use interchangeably, but to mean different things, think, feel, and believe. Many of us will say, I feel that this is a good book, when we really think that it's a good book, or believe. To believe and to think and to feel are three different things. And don't say I feel when you mean I think. Feel refers to the emotions you're having, the senses you're having, and thinking refers to the rational, the cogitation that you're engaged in. And just be alert to that, because you ought to hear yourself when you use the wrong word. When you say I feel when you mean I think, and pretty soon you'll get in the habit of using the right one all the time. So check that out. And then the third one, just to get these forbidden words off my chest, is hopefully. You know, we're all guilty of using hopefully in an incorrect way. Hopefully is an adverb, which means it modifies some verb. Just like I sing happily, or I walk swiftly. It tells you how you do something. And hopefully means to do something with hope, or even full of hope. And people will say things like, hopefully they'll give up. You know, how can you give up when you're full of hope? That sentence, hopefully, has to modify give up. What we're really meaning, I hope. Whenever most of us say hopefully, we mean to say I hope. And that's what we ought to say. Rather than say, hopefully we can go to dinner now, which means we're walking over to dinner hoping that it's going to be a good one, perhaps, hoping that we'll like the food or that it won't be egg cock or liver and onions.
Liver and
onions. Oh, great. So try to use the word hopefully correctly, and notice how often in the next couple days you'll hear yourself or somebody else using it incorrectly. We shouldn't get too self-conscious, though, about our speaking. That is, we can cripple ourselves verbally if we walk around saying, now, I mustn't say hopefully in this next sentence. What I'm talking about is how to improve the writing that you do when you're trying to express something at your very best. I use incorrect grammar sometimes. I use hopefully sometimes. I do some of the other things I'm going to tell you, primarily when I'm talking. When I'm trying to write something carefully, I generally avoid these bad habits. And I'd feel horrible if you all walked around suddenly being overly critical of yourself or of other people's speaking. But we all ought to be working gently toward better verbal habits, and that's what I'm suggesting. But, you know, go ahead and still be natural, but when you're trying to be a little bit more formal by writing an essay, why, then be more careful about these things. One of the worst things you can do to me, because I'm an English professor, is to apologize for your grammar when you're speaking or writing a letter. I just hate it when I get a letter from somebody and they say, oh, that was an awful sentence I just wrote, and here I'm writing to an English professor. Or, you know, when you realize you misspeak grammatically in my presence and turn and say, oh boy, I really said that badly, didn't I? I don't walk around very often. You know, I'm aware of it when the bad grammar happens, just like Liz is. You know, when you notice it, but it's horrible to think that other people are thinking that we're noticing it, you know, and or thinking that we're being critical. You know, I love to hear language used gracefully, and I cringe a little bit when I hear it used ungracefully, but don't hold it against a person or think less of a person for it. And none of us should. You know, we just ought to work toward more ideal language. A couple of other things, and then we're going to look at some of the sentences that you wrote. There was a fair amount of misspelling on the papers, and I just urge you to, when you write, to be careful about spelling. If you're a chronic bad speller, as some of us are, and there are certain words which I still have to look up all the time when I'm writing, have somebody else check for you. And the frustrating thing about spelling is you look at a word and it looks right, so you don't look it up. You know, you don't even suspect that it's misspelled. So it helps to have somebody else look it over for you. And furthermore, when you don't know how to spell a word, it's hard to look it up in the dictionary because you don't know where to look. But one thing we ought to be aware of is how much it lessens our credibility when we're writing something to someone else and we misspell or we mispunctuate. No matter how good our ideas are, some people will simply reject it out of hand or simply say, oh, it's too bad that this person can't do a better job. But the impression you make on somebody else is less if you misspell and if you have sloppy punctuation. And if you care about presenting your ideas to someone else or presenting a good image of yourself, you're much more likely to do that when you write if you do it with correct spelling and correct punctuation. You know, if you picked up a book written by some famous scholar and there were 3 misspellings on every page, and half the sentences weren't even punctuated correctly, I dare say you'd not finish the book, and you'd have real doubts about the wisdom of that person, to say nothing of the publisher and the editor and so forth. You just would think less, you'd give less credibility to that person. And the same thing happens to all of us. So pay some attention to that, and I'll talk about some specific punctuation faults soon. The place to begin in improving your writing is with the verb. If you want to make some rapid strides in writing, here's what I suggest you do. That you take any draft of an essay you've written and take a pen or a pencil of a different color and circle every verb that you've used, the main verb of every sentence. And then look at them and ask yourself, how exciting and how imaginative are those verbs? You'll find that most of them are various forms of is, are, was, were, or bland verbs like have, or give, or get. And almost nothing with any image to it, any movement, any punch, any force. And you'll just be, in color, sure, you'll just be amazed at how your prose will just leap to life if you use good verbs. Mark Twain said the difference between the almost right word and the right word is the difference between a lightning bug and lightning. I think that's just a good metaphor. And it's true. If you look at one of your sentences that just has is or have as the verb, and then pick out a better one. You'd just be amazed at how much better your writing is. It doesn't mean that every sentence has to have a spectacular 50-cent verb in it, but to have variety and some sense of movement or a verb that creates an image or a sense of motion. And we'll do that with some sentences. Two other things to avoid about verbs. The verb to be, that is, are, was, were, we should use sparingly. Some of you, once you look at your essays again and circle your verbs, you'll find that half your sentences have as the main verb some form of is. Now all is an equal sign. Notice I used three in a row right there. All is an equal sign. It says that one thing and another thing are identical or equal. Has no sense of movement or color or motion. And when you use them over and over and over again, if you wonder why some reading is dull, analyze the verbs, and you'll find that, you know, it's this sort of thing. Now, in some writing, we have to use is a lot. For instance, if you're trying to define something, the whole process of definition is saying that this is that, and you have to use it. It's a very important and helpful verb, but it shouldn't be in every second sentence. Now, related to this is the second point, and that is to avoid the passive voice. Now, if I've failed at anything in teaching freshman English, it's in trying to help people understand what the passive voice is. You wouldn't believe what I've done. I've taken some classes of St. Olaf students, brilliant students, all of them. And I've given them a four-point quiz on the passive voice. And I've given them all the answers in advance. Said, here are what the four questions are going to be, and here's what the four answers are, and I'm going to quiz you on that next time. And I expect you all to get them all right. And the first time I do that, a third of the students will get them all right. And all I ask them is, what's the passive voice? And how do you put it together, and then write a sentence with the passive voice, and write another sentence with the active voice? And I tell them what page it's on in the textbook, and we put the answers on the board. But still, people goof it up. And here's what the passive voice is. it's that grammatical construction where the subject of the sentence is acted upon instead of doing the acting. And here's a simple example. The boy hit the ball. The verb is hit, right? And who's doing the hitting? The boy, and the boy is a subject of the verb, subject of that sentence. Boy hit the ball. The passive voice is like this. The ball was hit by the boy. Subject of the sentence is the ball. And did the ball do the hitting? No, the hitting was done to the boy. So the verb was hit is what we call the passive voice, because the subject, in a sense, is passive and the action is done to it. It's all. It's very simple, don't you think? Well, so in the way you form the passive voice, you have to have, as a helping word, some form of is. The ball is hit by the boy, or was hit, or will be hit, or has been hit. Always there's an is, a was, a were, a been, some form of the verb to be. So that if you do go through your first draft and circle every verb and find all these is's, was's, and were's, you'll find that a lot of them are hooked up to a passive, part of a passive voice. And the passive voice, if overused, really clogs up sentences as well and makes for very dull reading. There's not much sense of motion and power and action. So just as a starter now, this is a couple of things to look for in your verbs. Circle them. We'll do that in a few minutes with your essays. Look for variety, for some kind of interest and excitement in your verbs. And watch out for using the passive voice too much. And if you revise those things, get rid of the passive voice, you'll be amazed at how much more interesting your prose becomes. Now I'm going to send around these sheets of paper. The ditto didn't come out perfectly, but I think you can read them pretty well. All of these sentences are taken verbatim, uncorrected, from your essays. Now, each one of these was handed in, and I always assume when something's handed in that it's the evidence of the best writing of which you're capable, and that's what you want to be handing in when you're doing formal writing. But each of these sentences could be improved, can be improved, and shall be improved by you. And what I'd like us to do is to take them one at a time, and they are taken randomly. Well, I picked them out carefully, but from a random group of your essays. So we don't have the privilege of the context, the whole paragraph from which it's taken. But you recognize your sentences in there. But let's see if we can see ways in which any of these can be made better. The first one, among the many cracks we all have in our lives, there are a few early cracks that seem to be the most memorable. Now, is there anything that you can suggest that might improve it? Now, okay, it could be shorter. How could it be shorter?
Well, you mentioned cracks, right?
Yeah.
Maybe there's something that could be making one of the cracks.
Okay, the word cracks is repeated. That's a good red flag to yourself. Anytime you repeat a word or a phrase within one sentence, or even within a couple of sentences, it's a sign that maybe you could be more economical and condense something. Well, how can we get rid of one of those cracks? First, let's do this. Circle the verbs. Okay. What have you circled? Have, are, seem to be. Okay. Pretty bland stuff, isn't it? Two of them are forms of the verb to be. How could we revise it in such a way that the sentence has a little more punch, gets rid of one of the cracks, and maybe gets improved in some other way?
How about among the many cracks we, instead of all have in our lives, how about we all experience?
Okay. Yeah, do you think that's a good improvement? Instead of have in our lives, just experience? Much better choice of verb, isn't it? Okay. Another way would be to change that from a subordinate clause to a main clause. We all experience many cracks.
I can't think of a verb, but there could be a verb that could be more like a bombing or crashing in or
okay.
The word crack as a verb.
Yeah, that's what you're trying to think of there.
Or say we suffered from cracks, but that's okay. Kind of an old-fashioned word.
That's fine. But let's try to work with the stuff we've got here. One thing we discover, you know, is that there are lots of different ways of making a sentence better. And, you know, we could make infinite improvements on some sentences. And we'll just see if we can come up with two or three fairly effective ones. Well, let's say, among the many cracks we all experience. That's an agreed-upon improvement. Okay.
A few remain memorable?
A few remain memorable. Does that... Okay, that we lost the sense of early there. Okay. A few early... How do we say it? a few early ones remain memorable.
Yuck.
I think that remain memorable is a little
redundant.
Yeah, thank you.
If it remains, if we remember something, it remains. So we need to say it a little bit differently from that.
Okay.
Okay.
How about remember?
Okay. And how do we, what will we make as the subject of the sentence then? Do you want to get the...
We remember.
Good. Okay. Among the many cracks we all experience, we remember...
A few early ones.
We've lost a little bit there. Mm-hmm. What have we lost?
The emphasis on...
Right, we lost that superlative, the most.
Mm-hmm.
So let's get it back in there somehow.
I see. The sense of this is that the most memorable ones are
early.
In that.
The early ones, right.
Okay.
You don't forget the others.
Yeah.
Okay, can we say it in some other way using this change?
We remember most.
We remember most? A few early ones.
Okay.
Here.
Yeah.
Okay. You're cutting it down in really much more and saying, we remember our earliest cracks the most. Something like that.
How about
among
life's cracks?
All right. Among life's
cracks,
we remember the early ones the most.
Okay.
See how much better a sentence that is? It's much simpler. Gemma said that the way we could improve this is to make it shorter. Almost always a shorter sentence. You know, when you improve a sentence, you make it shorter. It's almost a law that's what happens. And you cut out a whole bunch of junk. One of the problems about this is that the sense of seem. That seem to be the most memorable. If you are remembering them, the sense of seem probably isn't appropriate here. You know, they are the most memorable. Okay, we've come up with a couple of good improvements. Do you have them written down there? Several ways of doing it, but we've gotten rid of the double cracks. We got rid of both forms of the verb to be. We got rid of that have. The thing to do, one rule is to write with verbs rather than with nouns. That is, take the key idea of the sentence. If there's a key word and you find that you've put it into a noun, try putting that into the verb. As we did here, among the many cracks we all have in our lives, that isn't a very good example. Yeah, we took memorable, which is an adjective, and said we remember. That's putting the key idea into the verb. And have in our lives, we really picked a better verb there with experience. Okay, let's look at, we'll take a couple of the shorter ones here. How about the third thing here? Only in our deepest despair can any glimmer of grace be seen.
Well, they're trying to do some alliteration of the deepest despair and glimmer of grace.
Okay. Is that good or bad? Okay, it is alliteration, deepest despair and glimmer of grace. You know, it's kind of a nice setting off of contrast. So, circle the verb. Okay. Okay. That's right. That's really the only thing I wanted you to see in this sentence, and it's probably the only improvement that this sentence needs. Only in our deepest despair can we see any glimmer of grace. It's just got a very nice rhythm to it. In other words, this sentence was almost terrific, and but it missed the mark a bit because that passive voice. And furthermore, who sees any glimmer of grace is not identified. The problem with the passive voice is that we ask, can be seen by whom? You know, sometimes in our deep despair, somebody else can see a glimmer of grace, and we can't. And the seer here isn't identified in this sentence. And if you want the reader to understand that only when we are in our deepest despair can we see a glimmer of grace, then we ought to use the active voice and identify the seer. And you've done that well. How about the next one? Nothing my parents said seemed to be of any comfort.
How about getting larger than it seemed to be?
Okay. Nothing my parents said was of any comfort. That
seemed to be
how about comforted me?
Good.
Okay.
See, well, the thing that Margaret did was to replace, you did make an improvement, but you ended up with a verb to be. You know, you used was, which then I would hope you'd circle and say, well, I can do better than that even. And if you put the key idea into the verb, in its comfort. Mm-hmm. Nothing my parents said comforted me. Mm-hmm. Much better. And again, the word seem here is misleading. I don't think the writer really means that the person couldn't tell whether there was any comfort or not. Usually you're able to say it was comforting or it wasn't. Not that, well, I wasn't sure whether what my parents said seemed comforting or not. It's one of those cases where the comfort is felt or it isn't. Okay, good improvement there. How to correct my feelings and actions hasn't become an understanding to me. Okay. It's one improvement. I don't understand. See how understanding is a noun. And if you write with verbs instead, take that key idea out of the noun form into the verb. I don't understand how to correct my feelings and actions. It's a much better sentence, isn't it? See what a kind of limping sentence the first one is.
Go over that again. I'm not sure what the difference of that is.
Okay.
See it, but not.
Well, listen, see if your ear tells you at all which of these is more effective. How to correct my feelings and actions hasn't become an understanding to me. Or, I don't understand how to correct my feelings and actions. Or you could say, how to correct my feelings and actions, I don't understand. But that sounds a little awkward. To become an understanding to me? Right. That's an extremely awkward construction. I think that we just don't use the word understanding in that way. It has become an understanding to me. Okay, you're doing a great job. Theology is and has for many years been a way of thinking, feeling, and responding for me. Pardon? No, it's not passive. It uses the form of uses the verb to be, but it's not the passive voice.
Is the punctuation off?
Okay, well that's part of the problem, isn't it?
I think it should have been the past. Theology is and has been many years.
Good.
Yeah,
you see that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Where's that again?
Theology is and has been for many years a way of thinking. You see how awkward it is to split been away from has. Because if we take out the parenthetical phrase and has for many years, it reads, theology is been a way of thinking.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you don't want that to.
Because the noun needs to be changed to a verb.
Okay, is there a way in which we could.
Something like that, I think, feel.
For me, on the end, it's too important to have it, isn't it, to have it at the
Right. That's a misplaced modifier there. It's awkward there. Where would be a better spot for it? Right at the beginning. For me, theology is and has been for many years a way of thinking, feeling, and responding. Okay, that's an improvement. Okay. Yes, very good. Okay. All right. Is there another way of shaping up the sentence so that we can get thinking, feeling, and responding away from a noun form? See, it's the object of the, they are all object of the preposition of.
One little clue about some of this is that I talked to a publisher once who said anytime they got a poem that had an ing ending on it, they automatically threw it out. ing, nothing. You know, active verb. That's carrying it to an extreme. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're at times, so you have to use them. But if you can think of a way to say think, feel, and respond, it's got to be better.
Okay, how can we do that here?
Well, I think it sounds very nice.
I mean, would this be changing it too much to say, I have thought, felt, and responded theologically for many years?
Like that?
I'm not sure if I like that.
No. No.
Okay.
Because it takes away from the theology is.
Okay, it suggests a little bit more than what this sentence mm-hmm. suggests.
How about a way to think, feel, and respond instead of thinking, feeling, and responding?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, how would the whole sentence read then?
Theology is a way to think, feel, and respond.
Okay.
Say,
I see.
I think, feel, and respond to. I have to theology for many
years. Well, one improvement you've suggested that is, theology is and has been for many years a way to think, feel, and respond, with the for me at the start. Another possible thing would be to say, for many years, theology has helped me think, feel, and respond. Maybe that doesn't have quite the exact meaning. But we get rid of the verb is that way. Any other suggestions on this? We've got several good improvements already.
Well, the thing you feel in responding really isn't all that horrible, is it?
No. Okay, well, let's leave that one. We've got some good suggestions. Let's look at skip the next one. I'm taking the shorter ones just because we'll get through more of them. The struggles continue, but the questions are different. Okay. The struggles continue, but the questions change.
That's
right. You just use differ. Struggles continue, but the questions differ. Now you notice how you get it. Creates that rhythm of parallel construction, and almost always that creates a better sentence when you put things in kind of parallel grammatical form. Questions continue, struggles continue, questions differ. Okay, see how simple this is, and what you want to get is so that you can, when you see this, when you write this kind of a sentence, you've got to take the time to ask, can I improve that? And you know, already you're doing a great job of spotting some things that are very simple to improve.
Oh, it's easy to improve someone else, though.
Well, some of you have improved your own here. I know who wrote some of these. Next one. They, instead of helping us, demand of us.
They demand of us instead of helping us?
Okay, they demand of us instead of helping us. Okay, that's better. It avoids those two awkward pauses in a very short sentence. Mm-hmm. Any other suggestions?
Instead of helping, they demand of us.
Okay.
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 They don't help us, they demand of us.
Okay.
Or you could say they make demands.
Yeah.
Okay. They make demands. Demand is kind of awkward one because we don't use it very often again in this idiom, demand of us. We usually say make demands of. One thing you'll notice too, that in many revisions you find yourself getting rid of pesky little prepositions like of.
Mm-hmm.
Flaubert, the great French novelist, had a rule for himself. He allowed only one de per sentence, only one of per sentence. It's a good rule for any of us. If you, another thing, if you want to circle something and realize that you've got a bunch of ofs, or if you find that you've got four prepositional phrases in a row, in the middle of the beginning of the concert in the hall, you know, that is a sign that maybe you should have restructured the sentence a little bit. But start out just with ofs and worry about the other prepositions later. Okay, all the more, here I just used a part of a sentence. All the more crushing in that they are caused by friends. Good. All the more crushing because okay, notice that in that almost always is unnecessary. It's one of those phrases that we have to use when we've painted ourselves into a corner.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only way out. And what we need to do is to restructure the whole sentence or a major part of the sentence so we aren't put into that corner. All the more crushing. Well, when doesn't he have the same logic?
Because friends caused him or something?
Okay, we've got a passive voice here, don't we? They are caused. If we put it in the active, as Keith has, all the more crushing because friends caused them.
Even more crushing.
Or even more crushing because friends caused them. You see how much more punch that's got than stretching it out? Okay. This action is so natural and done to make us even throughout, yet we complain. And I didn't include the rest of the sentence.
Even throughout, what does that mean?
The writer here was meaning kind of level or uniform. Okay, I'm glad you noticed that. The word so is almost always, no, that's not correct. It's very often misused. We use it as an intensifier. And back in my more sexist days, I referred to this as the feminine intensive, because somehow it seemed to me that especially young girls would use it more often than males, and I'm not sure that's correct, but we say it was so good, and it was so exciting, and so nice. And all we're doing is you know, in saying it was, it's like using the word very. We're trying to make it more intense. Now, one night, when I must have been grading freshman themes all evening, and I woke up having a nightmare or something, and I invented Wee's Law. And vary your adjectives, don't vary them. It is, if you have to stick the word very in front of, say, an adjective or an adverb, it was very good, it was very nice, which is like saying it was so exciting and so beautiful. It means that we didn't pick a strong enough adjective in the first place, right? So we had to intensify it. We ought to do what John Donne did in that poem this morning and simply pick a stronger verb in that case. Instead of saying it was very exciting or so exciting, we should say it was spectacular or exhilarating or, you know, some word that carries
far
in
out.
Itself far out, right? So this is simply the principle that if you find yourself using the word very or so or in the opposite of an intensifier, I don't know what the word would be, a de-intensifier, is rather. What was rather nice? You're kind of taking the edge off of it. whereas so, you know, makes it more intense. It's just the opposite. If you find yourself saying rather or very or so all the time, get out your thesaurus and pick out a stronger adjective or verb and notice how much better and usually more precise you'll be. The English language is just marvelous for its resources of language that can say exactly what you want. So good, I'm glad you noticed that. This action is so natural. The time we do use so is when it's followed by a that. That is, it was so good that something happened. In other words, we're saying it was good to the extent that such and such resulted. And that's the time you want to reserve it for. And often, sometimes as we read, and you see so in front of an adjective, you think that that's what's about to come. And you set up in your mind the expectation of a result, and you're thinking of it as good to the point that, or
with
the result that...
so good that I had.
Yeah. And then you find out that's not what the writer did at all, and you have to go back and reread the sentence. So, all right, any other improvements here?
I would use instead of done.
Action is so natural and used to make us even throughout. I think the what the writer was referring to in the previous sentence, that done is really more appropriate, and that you can't tell because you don't have the other sentence. Any other improvements here? I think
what
we can
use instead of so natural. What other word would like this action flows naturally? And it was pull out
is.
Okay, yeah, if you want to keep the so, we're pretty much forced into saying this action is so natural that, and that's what we ought to have, and we don't have that here. And we may be losing a little bit of the sense of the sentence in some of the changes that will occur to us, but we probably aren't going to violate very much here. You suggested this natural action?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have to... playing with this natural action intended to even us throughout causes.
Okay. Okay. This action, comma, intended to even us throughout. Okay.
I would pick a different word than even just because it's misleading to people.
Okay.
Like we don't know quite
right. Well, the writer, as I recall, was using a metaphor of pottery, I think, and you know, talking about making the walls of the pot even, or some such. So in the context here, it was appropriate.